have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning to you.
All right, let's begin with local developments this last week, and our own local bad penny, Jan Drago.
Now, what's wrong with Jan Drago? She's a good Democrat who served the city of Seattle well for, well, she's actually served the downtown business community well for many, many years. And
Did you say Democrat?
Oh, wait. It was the Republicans who this week actually got Drago appointed to fill Dow Constantine's vacated West Seattle County Council seat. And this has been a very curious turn of events. The problem, as we explained the last couple of weeks on this show, is that with the initiative that was passed in fall of 2008, making the county council offices nonpartisan, the council had no way of deciding a vacated office when they're deadlocked 4-4 to fill a vacant ninth seat. The county charter requiring that the vote of the other council members be what decides how to fill a seat. And it used to be that it was the party of the vacated seat that would appoint the vacated seat. But since there are no longer supposedly relevant parties in the county council, that process was abandoned, and there was no process to replace it. And quite literally, if they had not been able to solve a way to fill the 4-4 deadlock, there would have been only 8 seats on council all the way up until a November election, and the West Seattle seat that was vacated when Dow Constantine was elected King County Executive would have remained unfilled all this year.
Yeah, and we would have seen a lot of split votes.
And yes, because the county council is functionally still partisan, even though in name the Republicans managed to get it voted to not be, you would have seen a lot of split votes, and you would have seen the county at a time when it has to fill a yawning budget crisis, a shortfall, and any number of other urgent problems would have been pretty badly handicapped all throughout the course of 2010. So they finally reached an agreement this week because County Councilmember Lori Phillips, a nonpartisan, non-affiliated person who used to be known as a Democrat, jumped over and joined the people who used to be known as Republicans in order to get Jan Drago, who's I think fair to characterize as a moderate pro-business Democrat, appointed to fill the seat of what is probably one of the most liberal districts in King County. The reason that she was appointed rather than State Senator Joe McDermott, who was the odds-on favorite to be appointed and who was the choice of the Democrats in the actual district, was very much a political calculation and really shows the extent to which the county council is still politicized along party lines and how the whole nonpartisan thing has just really become a complete farce. And the calculation was basically this, that the Republicans were not willing to support anybody, even though it was the choice of the Democrats in the district, even though it might have been the choice of the voters in the district, if they were not willing to say, I'm not going to run for the open seat in November. So they wouldn't appoint McDermott because he wanted to run for the seat in November on a permanent basis, and he would have had an enormous advantage as an incumbent had he ran. They talked to State Representative Zach Hudgens from the 11th about filling it, but not only wouldn't he commit to serve as a caretaker, but if he served as a caretaker, he wouldn't commit not to run for his old state legislative seat in November if he didn't run for the county council seat. And of course, county council pays a lot more than the state legislature does, which is why it's considered more attractive. But the whole calculation behind this is a very naked, partisan, political consideration, which is the Republicans want as many Democrats as possible running for a seat that almost certainly will be filled by somebody who used to be known as a Democrat in November. But if you have people abandoning their state legislative seats in order to run for that open county council seat, if you've got 3 or 4 Democrats who do that, and at this point Constantine will almost certainly run, Hudgens will almost certainly run, there's two
McDermott
or three others who are thinking about
run,
it.
You mean?
Yeah, that sows as much discord and uses up as much campaign money and as much time as possible on the Democratic side. And it was that, rather than the possibility of paralysis in governing King County, which dictated how the Republicans voted on county council. It really is a pretty abominable example, not that the Democrats aren't capable of providing such examples themselves of party politics taking precedence over the need of the of the citizenry to actually have a functional government.
All right. Well, speaking of
and in the bargain, we got Jan Drago on county council for 10 months, which is also nobody's idea of a treat.
And thanks to Larry Phillips, who used to be, as you mentioned, used to be a Democrat who switched sides and voted with the Republicans on the council.
No, the former Republicans.
The former Republicans on the council, largely because Drago had been his campaign manager in his 1990 state house reelection campaign. So a little bit of back scratching there. Definitely benefited the former Republicans.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's move on to the Bellevue Human Services Commission.
Yeah, the Bellevue Human Services Commission issues a report on a regular basis on sort of the state of the need for social services in the city of Bellevue and on the east side. And this year they released their report. It had a couple of very interesting things in there. There was a big increase in demand for social services on the east side. Food banks saw a 31% increase in demand. Domestic violence services saw a 50% increase in demand. And there was a 49% increase in demand for emergency financial assistance. Just astonishing numbers for what we usually think of as a fairly wealthy part of the state, the Bellevue area and the east side. One thing that I found very, very interesting in the report is that it cited, its survey takers found that people that they talked to who needed social services in Bellevue cited as their number one top household problem the lack of adequate public transportation, that it's not convenient, and that most particularly it's not affordable. So it really points to, even though public policymakers and those folks we were just talking about who sit on the county council think that an annual 25-cent increase in bus fares is not a problem, it's a big problem for people who have to decide whether or not to pay the electricity bill versus pay their kids' medical care, whether they should, folks who have to line up. Yeah, folks who have to line up for food at the food bank, even though they're working a regular 9-to-5 job for minimum wage. You know, it really does make a difference when you have bus fares at $2 or more per trip. Really does make a big difference.
And it also really underscores how the demographics of King County have shifted over the last decade and a half, where as you've had these intentional policies by the city of Seattle that have gentrified the city, encouraged market rate new housing at the expense of the affordable housing stock that did exist, that a lot of migration has occurred where working class and poorer families have migrated out to the inner suburbs, to South King County, to Bellevue, to Renton, to Kent, to areas like this, which in some cases are more affordable now than Seattle is. And as a result, Bellevue, for example, has some of the largest immigrant communities in King County. And that's not how long-term residents normally think of Bellevue, but it is the demographic reality now.
Yeah, and we don't tend to think about how the folks who work for minimum wage and who are pushed out of the city really support the ability for employers to pay a higher wage to the folks who can afford to live in the city and who make lots of money and can buy $500,000 condos, etc.
All right. Moving on, a big court decision this week saying that felons in the state of Washington can vote.
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in Seattle this week that Washington's law banning imprisoned felons from voting violates the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And the plaintiffs used data showing that minorities in Washington state are stopped, searched, arrested, and convicted at much higher rates than white folks. And that this really, the judges bought this argument and they ruled in the plaintiff's favor. Now that's kind of interesting because we also saw this week that Attorney General Rob McKenna, before taking off on
Still is a Republican.
Yeah, who before taking off on a taxpayer junket to Israel, told reporters that he was going to appeal the ruling to the Supreme Court, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I found that ironic that after McKenna said, well, I don't really believe that Washington's law banning felon voters is negatively impacts minority communities, he turned around and took off on a trip to Israel, which has been accused of its own version of apartheid.
Yeah, I love how the Ninth Circuit basically made the case that that Washington State's felon law was irredeemably racist, basically, that it was rife with racial disparities. And so McKenna's saying, no, it's not. We would recognize such a thing if it ever occurred, and while taking off on a taxpayer junket along with Joey Rubin and John McCain to go to a country that's regularly accused of practicing apartheid.
Yeah, and what I find interesting too is the state argues that, well, we don't know how we would conduct voting in prisons, as if it were a difficult thing to do, and they cite the fact that all of inmates' mail has to be searched. Well, excuse me, but you can give inmates a blank ballot. There's no need to search blank ballots here. And you can allow them to mail out their sealed or to take out the sealed ballots. It's not as if outgoing mail absolutely has to be searched, especially when that outgoing mail is going to be opened and looked at by state elections employees. So there should be no conflict in how to conduct an actual election in the prison system in the Washington state.
Just as there isn't in almost any other state.
All right. Moving on to national, and starting with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, the EPA this week finally got around to making a proposal that it originally made in 2007, which was when its the scientific commission that was in charge of studying such a thing recommended that the current limits for allowable smog, that is allowable particulate matter that contributes to smog, would go from 75 parts per billion of ground level ozone to either somewhere in a range between 60 and 70 parts per billion. Now that shift would put King County, Pierce County, depending on where it fell in the 60 to 70 range, several other Washington state counties, and actually a fair chunk of the Midwest and Eastern Seaboard into violation of EPA pollution and smog controls.
Probably almost all of Southern California.
Almost all of Southern California as well. And interestingly enough, unlike many parts of the country, particularly back east where coal-fired plants and some other sources of emission are a big part of that, here it's almost all automobile exhaust. So
yes,
in order for the state and for counties to take corrective measures on this, they would almost certainly have to take some sort of measures to discourage driving, because driving is such a huge part of what contributes to their smog problem in this part of the state. Now, what happened in 2007 when this was originally proposed was that George Bush intervened personally to overturn the scientific consensus of the EPA and keep the limit at 75 parts per billion rather than the lower limit. Now, the problem with this new set of guidelines, if they are in fact adopted, that goes into a public comment period now, is that there's no new penalties for actually violating the laws. And for areas that are already in violation, and Southern California is an excellent example of this, because the Los Angeles Basin, for example, is in Los Angeles County, is routinely in violation of the 75 PPM
already,
limit. There really are no sanctions that are meaningfully enforced. In theory, the federal government can withhold highway funds, but in practice that really hasn't ever happened. So without some sort of enforcement mechanism, this becomes, something that you take note of, and, you know, maybe we'll just stop breathing until the air gets better. But it really needs to have some sort of enforcement mechanism behind it as well, to encourage politicians to make the tough decisions to do things like, encourage policies that discourage driving, to get people, get industry away from emissions and coal-fired plants and so forth. And, of course, taking any of those steps would also massively help in the fight against climate change.
All right. Moving on to developments this week nationally with regard to the death penalty.
Yeah, some good news for people who are against the death penalty here in the United States, the U.S. being one of the few countries in the world who allows our individual states to impose the death penalty as they so choose for certain crimes. The group that originally shaped the legal framework back in the 1960s for imposing and carrying out the death penalty, That group is called the American Law Institute.
Well, now, to be clear, they crafted the argument that it got the Supreme Court to reinstate it in 1976 or whatever it was.
Yes, they drafted up the legal argument and really set up the framework for how the death penalty could be applied once the Supreme Court allowed it to be reinstituted. This group is called the American Law Institute. It's a group of about 4,000 judges, lawyers, and law professors. This week they went back on that and they basically said that we are abandoning any support for the death penalty because the capital punishment system in the United States is irretrievably broken. It is broken and cannot be fixed. And they cited as problems racial disparities in conviction and sentencing, how the death penalty is enormously expensive to pursue for states that try to pursue it in death penalty cases, the risk of executing innocent people, the fact that death penalty cases are often used as political tools in judicial elections, and that is just a monumental step in the fight to ban the death penalty, to have the American Law Institute do that, to basically give it up and say it's broken and it cannot be fixed.
Yeah, not to mention that there's also no evidence whatsoever for a favorite conservative meme in that it doesn't actually prevent or have any kind of a deterrent effect on capital crimes.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, you know, it's a new year, and I thought it might be worth taking a look at how the economy's doing, particularly since December. We heard all this happy talk about how retail sales were going to pull the economy out of its slump, and the housing market is recovering because we had so many sales of houses in the summer and fall because of the first-time home buyer tax credit. Well, reality is starting to hit, and what we're seeing is that unemployment, which had a little bit of a recovery in November with a gain of about 10,000 jobs, a very tiny gain in the large economy that we have, well, it slumped again in December. We saw a loss of 85,000 jobs. Unemployment remains above 10%, and that's official unemployment. Unofficial unemployment is above 17% and could be as high as 25%, according to some measures. We're also seeing some other unhappy statistics. About 1 in 8 Americans now receives food stamps. About 1 in 4 children in that number. And food stamps is the one program that has become the safety net of last resort because of the limits on other programs, including limit to the number of months you can collect unemployment insurance. About half of the unemployed collect no unemployment benefits. This is half of the officially unemployed. About 6 million people who receive food stamps have no other income at all. So they don't collect welfare, they don't collect disability, they don't collect pensions, no child support, no unemployment insurance, nothing. 6 million people who subsist only on food stamps. And this is in the United States. You know, we like to pride ourselves in being a country where you can really pull yourself up by your bootstraps and live well, and we don't have terrible poverty. Well, you know, we have 6 million people living on food stamps only. That's pretty darn bad. And we should also take a little peek at the housing market. How is the housing market actually doing? Well, the number of people preparing to buy a house fell in December by 16, well, it fell in November by 16% from the previous month. Economists had expected a 2% drop. So the housing market is still suffering. And, sales of existing homes were up in November, but economists expect that to drop in December by about 10 to 20%. They're expecting another huge drop in sales of existing homes in December, and that's the optimistic estimate. And of course, prices are continuing to decrease in spite of the increased sale activity that we saw in the summer and fall. Foreclosure and short sales are still increasing. They were 1.7 million in 2008, over 2 million last year, and then the 2010 estimate is that they're going to be around 2.5 million foreclosures and short sales. And again, that's the optimistic estimate. It could go higher. And so we've got like 15 to 16 million Americans who are underwater. That's about a third of all homeowners who have mortgages. They owe more money on their house than their house is actually worth if they were to try and sell it. And all data is showing that unemployment may affect and drive people into foreclosure, but it is not the leading indicator of who is going to lose their house. The leading indicator of who is going to lose their house is whether or not you are underwater on your mortgage. And there are 15 to 16 million Americans out there who are underwater. So, 2.5 million, the estimate of 2.5 million foreclosures next year is extremely optimistic. So I just wanted to throw those statistics out there and give people sort of a state of the economy for the beginning of the new year.
Just our little bundle of good cheer for the week.
Yes. Yes. And then in the other economic news, the other big story was Ben Bernanke claiming that low interest rates throughout the aughts had nothing to do with the housing market bubble. And that's just plain absurd. You really cannot have an asset bubble without cheap and easy to get money. I mean, you cannot have a run-up in asset prices without a big demand for those assets. And the way you get a big demand for that asset is making money easily available to people. And while lax lending standards did have an impact, really the way that you get people to bite the hook, to go deeply into debt, is to say, hey, you can get a loan with a low or no interest rate. We see that every month. You see that when you sell cars. You see that when they're selling, you know, furniture, et cetera, low to no rates, et cetera. You know, all that cheap money is what drives an asset bubble. And for Ben Bernanke to say it had no effect at all on the housing market bubble is just patently absurd.
All right. Well, that then takes us on to the news you couldn't escape, the Christmas Day bomber.
Or the Undy bomber, or the crotch bomber, or my favorite, the Jerry Lee Lewis bomber. It really did get pretty absurd this week, the finger pointing and blame game that went on about who was really responsible for the failure in intelligence that led the United States to fail to detect that one person out of the 6.8 billion on the planet happened to do something stupid on an air flight coming from a foreign country to Detroit on Christmas Day. But there were a couple of particularly egregious arguments that seemed to get a lot of currency this week. That seemed to be particularly worth addressing. One is the Republican talking point that most famously was uttered by Rudy Giuliani, but several other people have mentioned it as well, that, well, under George Bush, we didn't have any domestic terror attacks. Yeah, Giuliani, the mayor of 911, actually said that.
In his own city.
Well, maybe because Republicans don't really think that big cities are, you know, real Americans, and therefore that's not an American soil. I don't know what the logic is.
I think he's probably got Alzheimer's myself.
Whatever it is. But, you know, above and beyond 9/11, you also had the incident that was most similar to the Christmas Day attempt, which was Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who, again, on a transatlantic flight, attempted to detonate a bomb midair and was stopped by other passengers. You know, that happened on Bush's watch as well. So that.
Well, and what was the guy who they stopped here at the border trying to bring explosives into Washington to try to bomb?
Oh, that was actually in 2000. That was under Clinton.
Oh, that was under Clinton. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know,
Rassam is his name.
Yeah, Ahmad Rassam. Yeah, these things happen.
Yeah, they do. And you know, the sad truth of it is they're going to keep happening as long as we keep, you know, annoying large parts of the world with our foreign policy.
Exactly.
So, but, you know, above and beyond that, there was also the spectacle of a number of intelligence experts saying now that the failure to connect the dots, the fact that various intelligence agencies had information on this guy, but they didn't put two and two and two and one and three and two together, is really a result of reforms carried into place immediately after 9/11, which allowed the federal government to collect so much data and information on people that there's literally so much information on each and every one of us now that that there's no way for even data mining programs, let alone human analysts, to separate the wheat from the abundant amount of chaff and actually figure out what the valuable pieces of intelligence are. So that, for example, the National Security Agency alone is constructing a data center for surveillance data in Utah right now that they project will be storing yottabytes of surveillance data.
What is a yottabyte?
I'm glad you asked that question. A gigabyte is a lot of...
Sounds like something out of Star Wars.
It does, doesn't it? A gigabyte is a lot of data. A yottabyte, there are 1,000 gigabytes in a terabyte, 1,000 terabytes in a petabyte, 1,000 petabytes in an exabyte, 1,000 exabytes in a yettabyte, and a zettabyte, and 1,000 zettabytes in a yottabyte. In other words, a yottabyte is 1 quintillion gigabytes. Only fire the Arabic-speaking Intel analysts because, you know, they might be gay.
Definition of too much information.
It really is. So the short version is, yes, they are watching us, and they are listening, and they are reading our email. And no, it probably doesn't matter because the information just sits there. So it doesn't matter unless you care about the potential for the government to make mistakes or abuse its power or something like that.
Yeah. All right.
And I wanted to talk about Yemen, which is turning out to be the new front in the war on terror. And as Jobs said, you know, we can go around trying to chase huge oceans of information, and we can force people from a growing list of countries to undergo pat downs in order to try to prevent the next crotch bomber, or we can try to address the real, you know, and we can start more wars in the Middle East as the U.S. is doing by pursuing airstrikes against people in southern Yemen, as they're doing in Pakistan, as we're doing in Iraq, as we're doing in Afghanistan. We can continue to expand that list and therefore create more and more and more terrorists, as we appear to be doing, or we can try to address the real causes of terrorist attacks against the U.S., which, as Jobs said, is our foreign policy, our support for corrupt governments like the government of Yemen and the government of Pakistan and the government of Afghanistan.
Or taxpayer-funded junkets to Israel.
Right, or we can continue to ignore what motivates a lot of these groups, which is not just fighting against their own corrupt governments, but also trying to find some kind of justice for the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
All right. If you can do it in 30 seconds, do you want to talk about Iraq, or is that
good? No, let's
all right, we'll leave
on
that for next week.
That'll wait.
Yeah.
All right. So that just leaves events.
One reading coming up this afternoon. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, actually, it'll be more of a presentation than a reading, but, again, the, Richard Wilkinson, who was on this morning at 7:30 with the new book, The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Societies Stronger, will be talking today from 2 to 4 p.m. in the, Communications Building, Room 126 in the University of Washington campus. So 2 to 4 p.m. today, Room 126. All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with news and humor and opinion and all those good things about local and global news. We are found wherever you find free publications, at bookstores, county coffee shops, King County Library System, and so forth. We're also... also online at www.eatthestate.org. We are in the midst of our winter fund drive because it is an all-volunteer organization. It does cost money to print the paper. We do owe the printer a lot of money, and, well, this is how we make it up, is by asking you, the reader and listener, for that money. So if you can, go to www.eatthestate.org, click on the PayPal donation button, or send a donation to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. If you've already donated, thank you very much. And if you would like to donate your time instead, or your expertise, or other volunteer energy, let us know. Drop us an email at info@eatthestate.org.